Okay, the date is February 23rd, and I'm here with Bishop Seaborn. And, first of all, Bishop Seaborn, when and where were you born?
Well, I was born in 1911 in Toronto, and my father was an Anglican priest, and he was rector of a church called St. Mark's Church, West Toronto. And before I was 3 months old, he moved to another parish in St. Cyprian's in Toronto, and I was grew up there with four brothers and two sisters in the it was a church which is now downtown Toronto, but then it was just an ordinary district in Toronto. And so I went to school there in Toronto, went to high school at the University of Toronto Schools, UTS. Then I went to the same college my father had been. I went to Trinity College in the University of Toronto, and I got my Bachelor of Arts in Classics. I'm never quite sure how I got into Classics, but I did. And then when I finished that, I decided that I would like to study for the ordination in the ministry. My father had died 2 or 3 years before, and this was also in the middle of the Depression was moving in. So I started theology in 1932 when I had my arts degree behind me, and 2 years later I graduated with a degree in divinity from Trinity College and was ordained. And I served for 2 years in a very nice parish in Toronto called St. Simon's, where they had a magnificent boys' choir, very famous boys and men's choir. Then I took a year off and went off to England and studied at Oxford University. Had a year there attending the lectures I wanted to and writing essays for tutors and that sort of thing, and traveling about. Then I came back to Toronto and was a curate at the cathedral there. And during that time I married my wife, Betty Gilchrist, and we now have 5 children, 4 boys and a girl. So I stayed there till 1941, with the war well on, and I knew that at one point I was going to join the forces, mm-hmm. but my bishop wasn't keen for me to join too soon. He felt I should have a little more experience, and I once thought I might join the Navy. I had the right name for that, you see. And so I wrote to the principal chaplain and asked him whether he needed any more padres in the Navy and whether they'd ever go to sea, and he wrote and replied negative to both questions, so I let that one go. But after, in the summer of 42, there was a new battalion of the Queen's Own Rifles of Toronto being raised, and they asked me if I would join that because they're padre, and I said, yes, I'd be glad to. My bishop said, that's fine, I didn't expect to keep you any longer. By that time, I'd taken on a parish in Cobourg, a nice town outside Toronto. And so they said, well, you haven't been with us a year. We'll see if we'll get somebody to look after the parish while you're away, and you can come back after the war's over. So that's what happened, and I trained in Canada for the best part of the year, one winter in Debert, where most people did. And then in the spring of 43, I was posted overseas and took a month at Aldershot, and then it was posted to the Canadian Scottish. Mm-hmm. And I had... I'd never been west, and they weren't very keen about Easterners, so I didn't tell them I was from Toronto. I told them I was a Coburgian. And so it took a little while we got on the same wavelength, I guess. Mm-hmm. But they were training in south of southern England, and we were getting ready for preparations for the invasion by then, and I headed off to Scotland, and we did a month's training and salt landings, and I climbed over the moors and so on, and so gradually we got to know each other, and I was with them for all through that fall and winter before the invasion, where we moved from different camps and finally onto the Isle of Wight, mm-hmm. and then back to the, as I'd say, Newfoundland, out of the mainland, and we made our landing on D-Day. So that's how I got there.
Mm-hmm. Just to go back a bit, what were your duties exactly with the regiment?
Well, the duties of a padre are somewhat spelled out, but not altogether. I was responsible in a general way. I think they would put it in the for the sort of moral and spiritual welfare of the men of the regiment.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, while they were doing all this training and waiting around, they'd instituted what they called Padre's hours, and so each week I'd probably take a period with one of the companies, and we'd have general kind of discussions about various things, some religious and educational and whatnot. And I used to visit them, get to know them in the barracks, and route march with them. I used to do, you try, I think, as a padre to identify with the whatever unit you're with. And until you're part of them and share their life and their experiences, you're not much use to them. You've got to give them time to get to know you and you them. It's the same really in the ministry. You don't walk into a parish and just know everything. You have to learn. So, taking Sunday services, and as an Anglican, I would celebrate the Holy Communion each week, and a few people would come, and we'd have. In those days, the church prayers were nearly all compulsory, which was so they came some more willingly than others, should we say. And the services were very straightforward, a hymn and some prayers and some scripture and a psalm and a sermon, you know, that sort of thing. They used to figure out half an hour is about enough, because most of them were standing. They'd hold the services in a YMCA hut or Sally Ann hut or wherever you could. And so, as I say, they came reluctantly or willingly or whatnot, and so you had not the easiest kind of thing, although they were there and you could get to know them and so on. So then you also, Padre, learned a bit about, had some ideas about first aid, and generally got fairly close to the medical officer. But mainly the year in England was spent in getting in shape and learning how to do the assault landing.
Mm-hmm.
And since the padre was expected to land with them, he had to know how to know a few things anyway. But we were non-combatant, didn't carry any sidearms even, and Red Cross armband. And on D-Day, I remember I had a haversack full of first aid material. That's right. So it was I think that the first couple of years were a learning experience, trying to understand what you do as a minister and as a padre in the forces.
Mm-hmm.
You had some people tell you a bit, but not very much. You had pretty much to learn on your own. Quite different in the kind of situation of today, when padres enter and they get courses and they get all sorts of forms to fill in and paperwork. We didn't have too much paperwork. I think they wanted to report each month from us, but that wasn't too onerous.
Mm-hmm.
But we very much identified with the troops and got to know them.
Mm-hmm.
And live with them and march with them and have some fun with them, that sort of thing.
Well, what sort of problems did you find coming up most often with the men while in England?
Well, in England, the Scottish had been over for about 3 years by then. That's a long time. So there were often problems at home. Sometimes you'd arrange for a compassionate leave, which occasionally happened, not very often, if they'd been, if the wife had died or something like that, or something really serious. But, and then you had, they'd get, tell your troubles to the padre was a well-known saying, and they sometimes want to talk to you about those things, and sometimes it was they wanted to get married to a girl in England, and they had some rules about that. The padre had to take a look at it and see what he made of it, and
mm-hmm.
try to make sure that both of them weren't married before, and that sort of thing, legally free to marry. And as I remember, there had to be some permission from the adjutant's office or the CO, as well as the padre. And then sometimes the marriages didn't work out very well in England, and so you'd see what you could do to help out then. That was part of it. And part of it, just talking with them, because they're a long way from home. I'd come in earlier, so I used to, first month or so, I used to tell them what had been going on in Canada since they left, that
mm-hmm.
sort of thing. That's right. Mm-hmm.
Had you had any experience with counseling people?
Well, as a minister, ordained person, you always, that's, you start doing that to host when you,
mm-hmm.
when you, in my day, it wasn't, you're not trained as formally as they are today. Theological students and the get a lot of formal training, far more than we did in that area.
Mm-hmm.
But you pick it up. You work as a curate. You've got a senior priest above you, and it's a kind of an internship. And so you learn quite a bit, but not as formally as you would today. You know, you don't have a degree in it. You know.
Yeah, right.
That's it.
How about with the regiment's morale? Did you have anything to do with that?
Well, they always hoped that the padre would be good for morale.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know. I never quite figured out how that operated. But we certainly was always expected that the padre had something to do with morale. I was never sort of instructed to say the troops have got bad morale, bring it up, or anything like that.
Right.
But sometimes it would be useful that you'd know that there is some things you could, occasionally you'd know one or two young fellows were getting pretty down, you'd want to refer them to the doctor or something. And in general, in England, especially since we are now, even though we've been there a long time, but we're getting ready for the great assault on Europe, and so everybody was looking forward to that and keyed up to it, even though you had some misgivings. But that year, there was a purpose in everything,
mm-hmm.
more than there was when you're just hanging around and training and doing more training and exercises. They're all now taking on much more of a purpose, and people realize that the balloon would go up soon, and so
right.
we were trying to get ready for that and to play our part in it and hope the casualties wouldn't be too heavy. That's about it.
So how did the men sort of deal with this approaching battle? I mean,
oh,
did you notice any changes coming?
Not particularly, no. They've been at it about 4 years, most of them.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them came in more recently, but they soon got absorbed into the unit. The strength of the Canadian Scottish, as of any good unit, lay in the fact that they were a kind of, we'd say today, a community.
Mm-hmm.
They're a pretty close-knit group, and with a great deal of pride in their unit and their flashes they wore, and pretty well officered, and the NCOs were experienced, so that there was a pretty good esprit de corps. There were some who got depressed, and some of them that didn't look as though they'd make good combat troops, they would get transferred perhaps to another arm of the service It looked as though they wouldn't perhaps be able to take the strain and stress, because there's a particular amount of stress and strain in this kind of operation, and nobody can keep it up forever, but most, if you're well-trained and well-led, most troops can manage a few battles, and recover from them if they have enough time to a little bit of rest in between. But I was learning as they were. I hadn't had a course in the psychology of fear, nothing like that. We were pretty well pitchforked into it, and whatever we'd learned previously and whatever we could pick up as we went along, we added to the pot.
Mm-hmm.
And talked to our fellow padres occasionally. We didn't see too much of them. We were all busy, each in our own unit. And so we just did our best, and when the assault came, met the next phase as best we could.
Mm-hmm. Maybe go back a bit, or what was your initial impression of the regiment when you came into it?
It was obviously a very close-knit regiment, coming from, and all of the officers, as it had been in the militia, they were sending a few of them home because they're getting into their 40s and they felt that was a bit old for combat duty, but they seemed to be a pretty close-knit group. They're obviously from the West Coast. I heard about British Columbia and the Canada begins west of the Rockies and all that sort of thing. So my knowledge of Canada was enlarged very quickly. But we quickly got on to some good-natured ribbing about that rather. But they were a little suspicious of somebody from the east coming in as a padre, because most of them were all from the west. You'd got a medical officer posted in from anywhere, and the paymaster, and that's about all. Otherwise, they'd be pretty much all their own group.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they looked at me with a little cautiously, should we say, at first.
Mm-hmm.
But we got along all right for a couple of months. trudging around the hills and doing going up to Scotland and doing a month there was a good breaking in point, and from then on I think we were seemed to be getting on all right.
So I mean, you trained right along beside them, you didn't miss out anything.
No, I had to do other things besides training, but I used to I had to certainly do route marches and take part in any exercises they held. And in the Padre's training, you'd have to learn to march and so on, and take place in parade at the back of the line as far away as they could put you, because you weren't generally the smartest soldiers. And we'd learn to, they'd had most of us, I think, at one time or other, fire a rifle and a Bren gun and throw a grenade or something.
Mm-hmm.
But ride a motorbike and that sort of thing, we learned those things. First aid and aircraft recognition, what everybody had to learn of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't become a specialist in combat arms or anything nonsense like that. I was a padre, and I moved around, and if I went, nobody told me I had to go on a route march. I just find out that the company was off the next morning, and I said, I'll join you. If I was free and didn't have other things to do,
mm-hmm.
sometimes a certain amount of correspondence even before the invasion,
mm-hmm.
writing to wives or to various people, and sometimes to the regimental ladies auxiliary here to see if they'd send over a layette for some fellow having his wife in England was having a baby and a little hard to find things and things like that. That's right.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Hmm. So you trained for the assault on Normandy, and going right up to the landing then, what was your impression?
Oh, well, that was something. We embarked, as you know, at Southampton, and then it was all put off for a day, and so we were on these ships, and there was a Sunday intervened at some point there, and I went around to about four or five of the ships where the battalion was and held a last service in each one of the ships, which was rather nice. I got around somehow, and then when we finally did set sail, and about 3 o'clock in the morning or something, they got us out of bed, not that none of you slept very much, and got out on the deck beside the landing craft's assault, and I went around to each of the groups and said a little prayer before we went over the side. They were mostly Canadian Scottish, and there were some English pioneers who were digging things and whatnot. So then we got into these assault craft, and it was a bit stormy, a bit of a wind up, and some of the men were a bit sick, and which wasn't a happy thought. And it took us about, I guess we must have been at least 2 hours coming in, 2 or 3 hours. They let us off a long way out. But we're nearly on time, if others could be more exact, but my recollection is that I was in a craft with some Baker company, and I had with me the sergeant and a corporal of the MIR, the Regimental Aid Post, as we called it then, and the MO went in with another company. He had a full corporal, I think, and a couple of others with him. So we divided up. And we landed about a little after 8. I think we're due to land at 8. We're about 10 minutes late. We didn't get quite ashore. They dropped us into about 4 feet of water, which was normal for them. But all these entanglements on the shore were there, and mortar and so on was flying around. So we got ashore. The only time I got any I hit at all was just a few minutes after we landed, I suppose. Some shrapnel was coming down, so I flopped on the beach and got a nick across the back of my leg and my hand, but that's all that happened to me. And I spent the rest of the next 2 or 3 hours. I was trying to think the other day, and they're kind of a blank, but I obviously spent them on the beach going around to men who were wounded and helping get them to some, they've been digging in on the edge of the, on the sheltered side of these sand dunes, and pioneers have been digging some kind of a trench for them and protection. So I helped bring them in, and stayed with them, and some of them were killed, of course. My sergeant that landed with me was badly wounded, and the corporal was killed. But I was with Colonel Whiteman. He and I were both hit the beach at about the same time, and the shrapnel started coming, and we were lying side by side. But that was just for a minute or two. And finally, about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, that time I sort of came, so I thought, look, I better find my battalion now. They've gone inland. I knew where they weren't supposed to go, but that's another story. So I didn't know what I was going to do, and then I saw there's some Bren gun carriers coming ashore from the battalion. They were coming in later. So I hopped on one of those and went inland about 3 or 4 miles and joined up with the command post party and stayed with them for a while, and I was glad to find somebody. It's a strange country, you know, and you wonder who's what. And so I moved with them, and again, I checked wounded people, and one or two places on the first day. I remember there was two or three of them in a field, and I had no way of getting them anywhere, and I didn't know whether there was any help for them, so I kind of nested them and put a marker up or something, and anyway, they seemed to be all right. They didn't be too badly hit, and they were all right, and so went on with them, and we got inland a long way the first day, about 8 miles, I think. So then everybody was to dig in for the night, but I was too whack for that, and I just lay down in the ditch. Went to sleep. They could do what they wanted.
That's the first day.
Yes, the evening and the morning was the first day, or the morning and the evening, whatever it was. That's right. So that was the start of it.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Were you stationed anywhere throughout the battle, or were you sort of just on your own?
No, I was, during battle, I always stationed myself at the medical aid post, the regimental aid post,
right,
with the MO, where the casualties would be brought in.
Right.
I had, not at first, because my jeep wasn't in first priority, I didn't get it for about 3 or 4 weeks, but I was stationed there so that I could see the casualties coming in and talk with them and make them a bit comfortable. I didn't do any first aid, didn't have to, they were very capable ones and we were never overwhelmed.
Mm-hmm.
Very occasionally I'd do something, but mostly I stuck to my own last, and if they wanted a cigarette, I always had a few of those around,
yeah,
and get them a bit of tea and talk with them. And sometimes if they're pretty serious, you try to help them if they're over the last bit. And but I stayed there pretty much during a battle. That's the place for you to be.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got my jeep, I'd sometimes send the driver. I'd go out with them to, when the casualties were more than the company jeeps could handle, we'd go out and bring them back. We had a rack on the jeep, and I brought them to help bring them back.
Mm-hmm.
And so during battle, that's where you were, and you were busy enough. And which wasn't far behind the line. You're pretty close, but you weren't advancing. You know, you were got up as close as you could to the when the attack went in, and found an old house or somewhere you could dig in and have some protection for the wounded. And then you stayed there, and they'd bring them back till 2 and 3 in the morning and things like that. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
That's right. So the MO and Padre, we got on very well. We had 2 or 3 MOs and always got on well together and worked closely together.
Mm-hmm. Apart from the actual injuries, what would you say the most common problem was, maybe psychologically?
Well, I don't need to see you. We weren't thinking always psychologically. Simpler days.
Right.
But people being injured, that was, you know, they were injured, and that was that. Very often it was great relief to them. They say, well, now I'm finished with that. I've got a blighty, you know, they'll send me back to England. But as soon as the battle was over, you know, we'd stopped and things got a little quiet, as they always did. You know, wasn't shells pouring over 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We wouldn't have had enough to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd then start moving around, and especially in the early days, after 2 or 3 days, we were in a very exposed position at Puto, and I decided it was time that some of those men who had been killed and were out in the open were brought in and buried. And so I started to see how I could do this, because I had no transportation and everybody was got their job to do. So I remember I got a hold of a two-wheeled cart out of the, we were in an old farmhouse, and a horse, and I got the sergeant of the officer's mess. I don't know how he ever did, but I told him anyway. I got Watkins, you know, I got him to help me, and we started going around and trying to pick up some of these men who'd been killed and bring them back. And I found looked like a little quiet spot, a little protected by a hill or something under an orchard. Got them, got some of the reinforcements, something to dig some graves, and I began to bury them. And I spent the first week or so, I was 10 days, it was a pretty grim business, hot weather, and so I'd wrap them in a blanket and take off their tags and pay books and anything else and put them together, and then I'd get a few of them, and we'd bury them and say their prayers. And then I'd sit down as soon as I could and write to the next of kin, and that was very exhausting.
Mm-hmm.
very difficult, psychologically, if you can put it that
right,
way.
Right.
But I was pretty young, and let's go to the bathroom.
And how did you go about composing these letters to the next of kin?
Well, you didn't do it the next day, but what you tried to do was you had the information from their pay book as to who the next of kin was. Sometimes you knew them. Some of them I knew fairly well. I've been long enough there. Others might have come up 2 days before as reinforcements. So I'd always try to have a word with the company commander, rather platoon commander, or the sergeant or someone, just something, if I didn't know. But then I would just have to write a letter saying that their son had been killed, and,
mm-hmm.
and I'd generally say where and when, you know, in action, killed in action. But I didn't go into gory details, because there was no way that that would make any sense to anybody. And so I just write a short letter trying to, and the officer, his office, the man's officer was expected to write to next of kin. I think most of them attempted it.
Mm-hmm.
But I tried to write, I wrote through, I was the Anglican padre, I looked after all the non-Romans, and I wrote all those letters, and I wrote some of the Romans too, though that we had a Roman Catholic padre, and I tried to get a hold of him. He was at Brigade. Many of the Romans had been killed, so he could use, if he wasn't there to say the prayers, I used the Roman prayers. We had the little, so we could say the some general ones, but the ones that they would say, you see,
mm-hmm.
over their dead. So, but I used to try to get their padre to write to them, give them the names anyway, and but I was closer to them, so I did a lot of writing. And I didn't know the people here, because I was from another place, so in one sense it was easier writing. I didn't know their name. You know, I didn't know their fathers
yeah.
and mothers. Some of them, the fellows I got to know quite well, and others I just knew them by name, or even hardly by that. And I'd always try, however, to have a word with somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And mostly they were, you know, if they died of wounds in the next few hours, I'd just say they were killed in action. I didn't see any sense in making it make the people at home feel worse. And we also, the adjutant, the Gray, who was sort of in charge of the order room and so on, we tried not to send out too many things home saying they're, you know, missing. And we held that up a bit. And I used to go around and try to find out if somebody's missing, if anybody could tell me. And sometimes they'd say, well, yeah, I know he found he's over there, or his buddies just lifted, put him under the ground, you know. So that I was able to, and we were able between us, I think, to keep the next of those messages of missing, believed, killed, down to a minimum if we ever sent any of them. We'd rather wait a little bit to,
right.
And send them if we'd identified them. And I guess I always felt that one of my responsibilities at this point was very much was to see that they were buried in their graves marked, and the report sent in to the Graves Commission or whatever, with a, the cross-references, map references, and everything else, so that, because we didn't have crosses to put up at the moment, you know, but so that they would, they could be found and
mm-hmm.
brought into the central burying grounds in time. And I think by the time we finished, there's only, when the war graves started moving around, I think there's only about two they couldn't find, and I was able, I went back and could locate them quite easily. So I think I sure Ray Gray greeted me, I just felt that that was one thing I could do, that I wasn't rushing around with a machine gun. At least I could look after this side of things.
Right.
So I tried. I guess I tried pretty hard on that to look after the to see that the dead were given a burial, and that I wrote to the next of kin. And the at one point the CO Colonel Cablehew was ordering me not to go out so far looking for these into this no man's territory, because he didn't think it was a good thing. I would just said, good money after bad or something. That wasn't the expression, no. However, I felt that I should do it, so I didn't say yes, sir, and I didn't say no, sir. I just was a little more circumspect about it,
mm-hmm.
because I felt you simply couldn't leave men lying up in front of their positions. Sometimes there'd be an officer who felt very late. Sometimes some of them, which you think the toughest, felt were most sensitive about this. And I know one officer who would never leave a man just few yards in front of his position unburied. He would see that he was buried that night, and then I'd hear about it later.
Mm-hmm.
But he just wouldn't leave him, he was, he got a, He was a decorated and all the rest, but on that score, that was a vulnerable point.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody has that. So as the war went on, too, I'd go up and have a meal with the company. If things were quiet, I'd go up and bring them any news I picked up. You know, I might have looked at a newspaper, the Army newspaper or something. You sort of carry around a bit of news and be cheerful. And I used to smoke a pipe and sit in the slit trench and smoke my pipe with them and produce cigarettes, because they're always sending me cigarettes, which I didn't smoke. And then I'd sometimes get a bit of tobacco back. So I moved around and tried to keep in touch with what was going on with them and visit them and kind of pastoral visit in an odd way, and till the next one started, and then you'd get back to your post and look after that. And so that's how it went for about 11 months.
Mm-hmm.
And as the war went on, I found it more difficult in the burials and those things, because I got some of the men that were just about, the war's about over, and then one of them's killed, and I'd known him since he arrived, you know, or since I'd arrived. And the men, too, they began to realize this, and they'd leave always some people out of battle at an attack. Instead of going in, absolutely everybody, you'd leave out of a company perhaps a couple of officers and two or three sergeants and a corporal or two, partly because they'd been in enough and they needed a break from it. You try to judge this. The MO
mm-hmm.
used to try to judge it, and he and I would kind of confer occasionally, because they'd come to see him, of course.
Mm-hmm.
So you would advise that the next attacks, X might be left out of battle. And you also left them out of battle so that if it was a bad one, you'd have something to rebuild on. And I began to realize then how that men, they all had a limit. And you just couldn't fight day after day without rest or without some kind of encouragement and this sort of thing. So that as the time went on, the morale, by the end of October, we were just exhausted, really. And you asked about morale. The padres, I got a word down from divisional padre, write a report on morale. So by this time I was about ready to do that, because I thought that we were getting pretty exhausted and not as and everything else. So I wrote quite a report on morale. It's one of the stories that we have in the regiment, I guess. So I sent it back, took off the tank, got sent it back. I showed it to the CO, actually. I drove it up myself and said, well, that's true, but I don't know if they want to listen to it. So I said, all right. So I named things which had adversely affected it.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you got wounded and you're sent back and they treated you like dirt behind the lines. And the only place you felt at home is you was in your own unit. You'd do anything. Many of them would come back before they really should, because they're not going to get, they just didn't feel at home anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And they were getting tired, and they'd been promised, they remembered.